years.
Yeah. Well, David, thank you for that totally inspirational introduction. High pressure in the mind. Right, so we shall call this what? Psycho Barrack?
Whoa!
That's not a compliment.
Well, talking about psychobaric matters, these is actually the shopping list of topics that David suggested might be useful for us to think about in the context of how we begin to imagine the state of condensed matter under, I would say, conditions that depart very strongly from what we're normally used to at one atmosphere. So what indeed is the state of, I've capitalized it here, relevant condensed matter theory, and I think relevance here is going to be gauged a lot by the people in this room as we go through this 2 weeks. What are achievable goals for equations of state, including solid systems, the fluid states, and ionic systems? What are achievable goals for transport properties? What are the accuracies and successes of current methods? And what new methods or approaches might we possibly consider? Impelled, I suggest now, by the conditions that are of interest to most people in this room. Now, as David rightly said this morning, what I think governs a lot of our business is the equation of state. And I want to make, in going through this shopping list here, some comments about that and the derivative properties. And as he well said, they become more and more stringent test of our ability to construct credible theories as we increase the number of derivatives. Much of what I have to say today is indeed impelled by element one, hydrogen. And I think probably properly so in terms of the what we heard is the makeup of the planetary systems that were being described this morning. I want to quote, to set the context here, from an article that David Stevenson wrote in Science recently. When was that, David? About 4 months ago, 5 months ago, something like that. And two comments he made, I thought, really put rather nicely the problem that's before us today, or these coming 2 weeks. The first was that there's a need for a fully integrated view of the planets. And I think in terms of what we heard this morning, the integrated view of the planets means, of course, how we begin to integrate our knowledge of condensed matter under ordinary conditions into the conditions that are being brought about by planetary interiors, the brown dwarfs, and so forth. David also said that planetary science has evolved into a multidisciplinary endeavor. And that's entirely true, and I suggest that at least one of these is the pursuit of condensed matter physics at conditions of high density, and that's of course just another way of realizing the effects of pressure, and at high temperatures, and that is where we begin to do something a little bit unusual, I think, for our theories of condensed matter, and that's to endow them with a very large energy content. Now, the beginnings of all this, curiously enough, are actually with our colleague Robert Boyle, and I should say our very much departed colleague, Robert Boyle, and I happen to find in his original works in our library at Cornell, a very nice quote that he said, and can you imagine now writing your papers to an editor and addressing the editor as your lordship? I rather like that. I can't really see, can't imagine Gene Wells being Lord Wells, but never mind. This is the real interesting part, because I think he was looking very much into the future here, which is that perhaps the pressure of air might have an interest in more phenomena than men have hitherto thought. Now, it's slightly politically incorrect to put it in those terms these days, but he's actually right on the mark, that that high pressures lead us to domains that of behavior, and I'll come back to this point later on, which I think, in view of our predilection for temperature as the control parameter, very often lead us to quite different view of the world. Now, some years ago, A.J. Jayaraman had a nice article in Scientific American on high-pressure physics. I wonder if my knowledge of optics is enough to do a little bit here and get this down a bit. Right. The pressure scales of physics, not quite.
Maybe the screen will go lower.
You think that might work? This now requires a knowledge of mechanics. Okay. Very good. Very good. All right. So now, the pressure scales of physics, as Jayaraman pointed out, I slightly modified his plot here. I think pressure, as he was pointing out, and I think probably you folk need no reminding of this, is a parameter that has, among the parameters of physics, one of the greatest ranges that's known. And all the way from 10 to the minus 32 atmospheres in deep outer space, where an occasional proton might come along and ping on a square meter that you'd put there, and if you waited enough, long enough, and averaged it, 10 to the minus 32 atmospheres, all the way down to the pressures that David was reminding us about this morning at the center of a neutron star. It's colossal. This band here is, roughly speaking, what we can get in the laboratory nowadays. Already that's pretty impressive, and you see some characteristic pressures here. Those of you with teenage children will know that this one here is perhaps a little underestimated. But we begin to generate in the lab nowadays with the diamond anvil cells that Raymond was telling us about, and indeed with nuclear shocks, even several of orders of magnitude more, pretty impressive means now of squashing matter. And that means, for what's coming in a minute, the reduction of linear length scales. Typically, for instance, if we're down here, the separations between atoms are being reduced by more than factors of two quite easily now in the lab on a routine basis. This is a very special region, as we've been hearing already, because it's thought that around here, hydrogen itself actually becomes metallic, let's say real hydrogen. And and that will be the subject of, I guess, an intense now debate on Friday. Now, the history of the experimental side is an interesting one because Raymond was laying it out, but it also has an interesting coincidence going along with it. The rise of experiment and its impact on theory in high-pressure physics is very interesting in the following sense. It's been about 60 years since the initiation of dynamic or shockwave methods. And as you heard from Raymond, these lead to a remarkable expansion of our view of phase diagrams, densities and temperatures. It's already been about 40 years since the Lawson-Tang paper on the possibility that diamond anvil cell. That's been around a while now. It's been about 17 years since the Maubel ultra-pressure experiment, showing that literally millions of atmospheres now are within reach of this diamond anvil cell technique. Now, what's interesting about that is that it's during this period that a lot of the theoretical techniques of condensed matter physics have actually come to fruition. It's been a very important era in our business. And here's the point I wanted to make, and I'll say it again now, that of the common thermodynamic variables, temperature has played by far the most prominent role in the probing of condensed matter, and particularly our theories. And I think it's fair to say now that P, not just T, but P now has very much come into its own as a variable of choice now in really probing at a quite different level our ability to characterize strongly interacting condensed matter. Now, it was Percy Bridgman who, in 26, noted the following, that pressure offers a route to the breaking down, as he put it in his paper, of the electronic structure of atoms themselves. Now, you have to think of the context. and the day. This is 2 years before Felix Bloch's theory on the beginnings of band structure. And already Percy Bridgman is suggesting that the fundamental building block is something which is no longer going to be immutable. And as he noted quite aptly, this can lead to an entirely different bulk properties. So the conditions that I think frame now the outline of this workshop, the planetary and so forth, they actually offer us an opportunity, as I want to now show, for studying the truly basic problem that underlies Carnot's matter physics, and in a word that can be stated as viewing matter literally as what it is, namely a collection, generally a canonical collection for us, but a collection of nuclei and electrons. And I'm going to set it up that way, and then, of course, beat the necessary retreat. It's something that we can't deal with yet, but except for one, possibly, and that's hydrogen. Now, with that by way of introduction, the plan that I had, I'm not sure how far I'll get, is to state this fundamental problem and as paradigms to look at the light elements. Light, and I think in the context that we're hearing about this morning, with atomic numbers less than or about, let's say, 29, which if memory serves is iron. Okay, and I want to emphasize that because of the remarks that have been made on chemistry, or the lack thereof, they're mixtures. And this problem, as you'll see, can be set out very straightforwardly, and I think probably it was Dirac who first did it, as an assembly of electrons, nuclei, and statistics. You remember he said the rest was chemistry. Well, fortunately for us, there was the immensity of N to deal with, and that turned out to lead to some extremely interesting physics indeed. Okay, so I'll look at, having set this up, I'll look at relevant theory under ordinary conditions, and that requires us actually to reconstitute the ions and electrons according to condition, having started off with this more basic view. Then to look at the remarkable consequences, and I think it's hardly appropriate that it's going on here in Curran Hall, of these theorems of Hohenberg and Cohn and of my colleague David Merman, which show now that the energy of these electronic systems are rigorous functionals of the one particle density of electrons. And this has led to, I would say, a computational juggernaut now that's chugging along. I mean, the consequences of the Cohn-Hohenberg theorems and the extensions, in fact, now to the classical domain that come about from David Merman's extension to the free energy are really remarkable. The amount of work that is now going on in what's generally called density functional theory. I'll say something about relevant theories that now applies as at high pressures and high temperatures, equations of state, and I want to say something is based on some recent work that we've done about perhaps what is a more popular way of looking very often at the cohesive and elastic and so forth properties of matter, which is through the route of multi-center interactions. Of course, we've all been guided since the inception of statistical physics on on pair interactions, but the story goes considerably beyond that, as we'll see. And if time permits, something about transport properties. And as a warning that simple elements are not often as simple as they might appear, if time permits at the end, I'll get to a specific case of the element lithium, which really surprised us. And now it's some of the surprises of the structure and electronic structure on that are showing through now also. And sodium.
Prior to Melmin, another question to Melmin and Hohenberg. You said that only depend on the density of the electron density?
The one particle electron density, yeah.
Does it mean you don't have to consider other densities, or is it, but it's still temperature dependent, I guess?
No, it means the following, that I think for many, many years we all pursued the wave function route, right, to studying the electronic properties of solids. And these, of course, in a many-body problem, are functions of, let's say, 10 to the 23rd variables, or in a planet, 10 to the 52, okay? And what would you rather deal with, something with that many variables or three? So the fact is that even though we don't know these functionals completely, they have led to a tremendous simplification of the problem, because it's a function now of the density, okay? And likewise, with respect to classical systems, the Helmholtz free energy, if you're dealing with a canonical system, is also a unique functional of the one particle density. So that's the vehicle by which now we tackle, for instance, the neutral systems as well. Okay. Right. Now, just before we begin, I want to remark that what we'll be dealing with today, and this is largely impelled by the talks that were going on this morning, are elements and their mixtures drawn from the top left-hand part of the periodic table. So, up here, this is not to say that the methods I'll be discussing are not applicable elsewhere. It's just to set a context for this particular meeting. So we're going to be looking at methods for dealing with these light elements going as high, for instance, as iron. These things marked in blue here represent elements where already at very high densities, by the methods that I'm going to outline, we find structures, and particularly electronic structure, that is actually quite counterintuitive. And I'll give an example at the end, as I said, with the case of lithium. And just to give you a hint of what's coming, I think we all expect in these so-called simple metals that as you compress them, the bands would widen. And in fact, what's going on here is that when you compress them to the point where their cores begin to overlap, the bands actually narrow. And I'll give the physics of that as we go along. What that has to do with the emerging problem, for instance, of transport is an interesting point, as we'll be seeing. Okay, so let me begin by at least setting down the problem I think we'd all love to tackle, if we could. Now let's start with something that we can tackle, and David Seppeli in particular will be, I think, talking about other methods for dealing with this particular problem, but suppose I take a macroscopic volume, put in a continuum positive charge density, and put in a sufficient number of electrons now to neutralize it, okay? And the electrons will have coordinates Re sub I. That, in a nutshell, constitutes the well-worn electron gas problem. And if we choose the volume and the background density appropriately, that defines for us, you may remember, this dimensionless parameter, which indicates the density of electrons, roughly speaking, if they were classical particles, twice the separation between them. If that dimensionless parameter, it's usually expressed as in units of the Bohr radius, happens to be around about unity, it's well known that this object here constitutes a Fermi liquid, okay, highly conducting assembly. If you get it up to, expand it now to about 30 times or 40, I can't remember what figure you finally settled on, was it around 40? No, you started off at 100, but later you went to around 40, didn't you?
Well, that's in two dimensions.
Oh, okay. Anyway, that thing, although, as we'll see in a minute, the Hamiltonian has a lot of tremendous amount of symmetry, both translational and rotational, symmetry gets broken, and this thing can form a Wigner crystal. All right. Now, that's one component of the problem that's coming. Now, let's go to a second component, and you'll see, in a way, it's the same problem in disguise. And now take the same volume, take the same continuum background, but let it have a different sign, let it have the opposite sign, okay, negative. And now put in, I call it in quotation marks, a gas of nuclei, right? And remember now that the mass of the nucleon is roughly 1840, the atomic mass number, and the mass of the electron, okay? So here, negative charges, electrons, here, the positive charges, okay? And so arranged now that the two background densities are absolutely identical. Now this one, if you choose your mass right, or A right, would pretty much constitute, in the right physical range of conditions, the classical one-component plasma that Hugh DeWitt and others have looked at in great detail. So what are we going to do to construct the fundamental problem of condensed matter? And we'll get to the mixtures in just a second. We'll take this and literally superimpose it on that. And the two backgrounds cancel, and you're left then with the interactions between like-like, and like-unlike. We'll do that in just a second. Now, just before doing this, notice that this thermodynamically leads to a perfectly well-defined problem. This thermodynamically leads to a perfectly well-defined problem. If we're setting this up in reciprocal space, the construction here simply takes away all of the Q equals zero terms in the Coulomb interactions that define this problem. So let's take those two, overlap them together, and there now is the light element problem in a nutshell. And you see from the way we've constructed it, the Hamiltonian of the system is the first one, the electron one at the top, the nuclear one, and then a far from benign coupling between them. In fact, this is so ferocious that it has the effect under ordinary conditions of immediately changing the character and condensing electrons around the nuclei and so on. It's exactly that process that we try to reverse in the application of pressure. All right, so there is the that's the thing we're actually dealing with to begin with. And the nice thing about planetary conditions is that, in fact, that viewpoint is something that we rarely get the pleasure of thinking about under ordinary conditions, but you folk can. There's a different way of looking at it if you don't want to go through the business of setting up the two Hamiltonians of electrons and nuclei separately, just go directly to it. But you remember I introduced for the nuclei and electrons these coordinates. Now, fundamental to our business here, once we've set it up at this level where you only have Coulomb interactions, fundamental to the whole structure of this Hamiltonian are these pair density operators. And they're formed from, I think what you all recognize is the ordinary single particle density operator, and it's the statistical average of this object here that gets us the fundamental classification of the states. Because, for instance, if that object on the microscopic level is homogeneous and continuous, we declare that to be a fluid. If the state is such of a Hamiltonian, for instance, the Wigner crystal of the electron gas, that the average of this thing is periodic, we declare that to be a crystal. So this is fundamental in deciding and giving definition now to the basic states of matter. Equally important is the average of this object here, which, as you'll see in a minute, leads to things like the pair correlation functions and the like. Now, for the electrons in particular, the one particle density operator and its average, the one particle density, is absolutely crucial now to the modern theory of solids because of the Hohenberg and Cohn theorem. the knowledge of this object and of the functional of this object that gives the internal energy at zero temperature in the ground state, this is an absolutely crucial quantity for us. And likewise, for the electrons, just as you've done it up here, we can define a quantity which is the two-particle correlation. And just to remind you and just say that once more, if a state happens to be one where the average of these quantities is constant in space, that's a fluid. If it's periodic, and of course it may be a dynamic crystal, as we know, that's what we call, that's the deciding factor, the defining factor for a crystal. If, for instance, we take a homogeneous state, right, a fluid, and take the average of the two particle density, it separates for a homogeneous state into the square of the average density and a quantity that's absolutely central again for a knowledge of the fluid highly correlated states, and that's the the G of R, the pair correlation function. So right at the level of the defining quantities that enter the Hamiltonian, we see emerging now the key quantities that we'll need to describe the systems as we go on. Now, one final point before we get on to how it all works. You don't necessarily have to go through the exercise of setting up the two sub-problems in the definition of condensed matter at the level of nuclei and electrons. You can go straight away to the just adding up the kinetic energy of electrons of the nuclei, and then the Coulomb interactions between the nuclei, and you see, not surprisingly, they carry the square of the charge and this key operator whose average leads to information on pair correlation and so forth. The coupling between nuclei, and that should be an E, and electrons, and then the corresponding one for electrons. It's important to remark that even though we set this thing up fundamentally, if you were dealing, let's say, with, well, let's say neon, which was on the chart this morning, Z equals 10, this thing describes neon in all its phases. It would be the vapor, the liquid, and the solid, and in particular, if we now take the density up very, very high to the plasma phases of neon, as we keep systematically stripping off the electrons in the shells as we go up in density. So this, of course, is an optimistic way of writing things down, but it is exact. And as I mentioned a minute ago, real life is basically a retreat from this, as we've been doing it over the years. But if we accept this and the principles of statistical physics, right, then the free energy is just minus kT times the logarithm of the trace of this thing, e to the minus beta h, where that is the standard statistical operator for a canonical system. And likewise from this, as David was mentioning, a somewhat more punitive test, if we knew how to calculate this, is to start taking derivatives, the equation of state. Measurables nowadays include things like, as we were hearing from Raymond, like the one-particle densities that in principle you can get from X-ray spectroscopy and scattering and so forth, and the transport properties. And of course, where the information on the Hamiltonian resides here is in the nature of the states that they provide in for calculating these current-current correlation functions. One point about the form of this, which will come up now on Friday, and it's worth remarking about now, is that for the case Z equals 1, we have hydrogen. And as you can see from here, when we start putting Z equals to 1, it looks pretty simple. Well, it turns out to be ferociously difficult and has been a real challenge over the years to get that one right. And I want to say a lot more about that on on Friday. But the interesting point about hydrogen is that there are no core states in it. And the methods that we've used to deal with these, some which I'll mention in just a minute, for instance, that rely on the concept of pseudo-potentials to start taking into account the conglomeration of electrons around these nuclei, are simply not available here. And that, plus rigorous theorems like the cusp theorem, that tells us that whatever the state is in, the average slope of the charge density around the proton must be directly proportional to the density itself, these provide powerful constraints on the kind of approaches that we can use for these systems. Now, note that hydrogen also is a dual fermion system. It's two renditions of the same problem. One for the electrons, one for the protons. Both fermions, right? But the two of them being in very different length scale ranges. But for both hydrogen, and writing down the problem here as I've done it, from the simplicity of this, you might suspect, for instance, that there would be scaling laws that would control the form of the internal energy and free energies, and that's exactly right. Melopoulos and I showed some time back that whatever the states these things are in, there are scaling laws that actually can take you from one set of thermodynamic parameters to another. So the point about writing it this way is that through these laws and constraints, there are actually checks on the theory. Okay, now some remarks about extending that just a little bit. And they're prompted by David's question this morning. Is there a general framework for proceeding? Now, I interpreted your question to mean, David, a soup, as you put it, I think, prosaically, where we weren't just dealing with an element as I've set it up now. And I just want to remark that with the very, very simple substitution now of going now from a pure system to an assembly, let's say, of nuclei and corresponding neutralizing electrons, okay, one can set up a whole host of completely equivalent operators that measure, for instance, the density of nuclei of type alpha, and then the pair density of nuclei of type alpha and beta. You can set the whole machinery up this way, and the fundamental Hamiltonian barely changes. So that, of course, is not an answer at this level to where the chemistry is coming from, but I want to remark that the structure of the starting problem is hardly changed. So this can all be set up now to to handle the case of mixtures and under the appropriate conditions, of course, that we'll be getting to, even the combination of the elements. If you were to switch off, for instance, the interaction between electrons and nuclei, now, that would be a rash thing to do, but if you did that and you just got the simplest estimate of the energy now, and how would you get that? You take just the Hartree-Fock energy of the electron gas, and then, recognizing that you do have charges of a different type around, just the electrostatic energy you get now, right, by putting nuclei at the center of a neutralizing electron sphere, and that would be the ion sphere model, Q, right? Then it's very easy to see right away that the energy per electron in terms of this average spacing parameter is this kinetic part, the part from exchange, and this part here, recognizing or reflecting the charge of the nucleus. Now that's a very interesting early and primitive estimate for the following reason. That if you simply plot this thing, it's got, of course, a minimum in it, and the position of the minimum, not surprisingly, starts moving inwards. And this you expect entirely, don't you? Because the electron nucleus part of this interaction is going to carry a length scale which will be Bohr's radius divided by Z. one sees that as Z increases, a deepening potential coming from the electrostatics. Now, of course, if you restore the interactions, what this is telling you is that the electrons can certainly do far better than this by changing their states. They can exploit the existence of this minimum, right, by changing the states and, in fact, going into bound states around the nuclei. So this is the beginning of the idea that the length scales associated with this problem here, particularly the A0 on Z, is a very, very important one. And I think that's where we get some of the primitive estimates about where matter will be completely stripped, right, under conditions of sufficiently high density. So what happens now in real life is that we back off from this completely stripped configuration in density, right? Then the electrons begin to condense around the nuclei. What we want to do now to move up to where, let's say, non-planetary matter is being considered is to reconstitute the system in terms of the ions and electrons. As soon as they start, this is an important point, because as soon as the electrons start condensing around the nuclei, the 1s states, the 2p, the 3s, and so forth, you begin to introduce a new length scale into the problem. You could call it the size of the ion if you like, but it's something which now reflects the scale of these electron states around the nuclei. Well, that's the first point. The second is that whereas in the original problem it's purely Coulombic, as soon as the electrons start condensing around the nuclei, we have to contend with the fact that they are fermions, right? There is an exclusionary effect, and you'll see this working quite extraordinary in lithium in a minute. And that, both of those, have to be incorporated into what we now call, for the electron ion problem, a pseudo-potential. And the interesting thing about high pressure is that the length scales going along with these pseudo-potentials are actually probed rather beautifully by some of the, the modern experiments. Okay, now if we move all the way up to matter under ordinary conditions, the manifestations of these pseudo-potentials, I think many of you are very well aware of. Firstly, they've been used as a perturbation on a homogeneous valence electron gas, not the entire electron system, right? But one starts off now with the idea of objects of finite size embedded in a homogeneous electron gas and then perturbed by the pseudopotentials which permeate, often periodically, this gas. And that's what's led to our earlier understandings. This is what was going on in the 60-year period, right, when shock waves were being developed and the diamond cells and so on. All these ideas of pseudopotentials are being developed to rationalize the well-known experimental finding that in spite of your expectation that you had these strong Coulomb interactions in there between electrons and ions, things like the electronic structure of the so-called simple metals were remarkably simple, extraordinarily simple. And it turns out that these pseudopotentials under ordinary length scales were very much at the heart of that explanation. All right, but secondly, or I guess thirdly, the other point that is a very interesting one on the way these things have been manifested is this, that the pseudopotential reflecting this length scale of the ion, reflecting the fact that the electrons on there were fermions and they were excluding in a non-penetrating way the electrons outside from reaching those regions where the potential would be strong, this led, after we traced out the electron states, to a procedure and a description again that I think intuitively we always almost run to, and that is to start describing the energy of a system in terms of an assembly first are pairwise interactions, none of Jones comes to mind, right? But with these pseudopotentials and with the nonlinear response of the electron gas, even now to three particle and higher interactions. Now, where the pseudopotential comes in, for instance, in the case of the pair interaction, is a very simple route. It looks at long range, for instance, just like the interaction between two-point charges, but the length scale is reflected entirely in this pseudopotential here. And if one works at the level of linear response and stops the series here, that's what has been used with rather good success, for instance, in looking at the dynamical excitations that ensue when one works out the phonons, for instance, of metals and properties of that kind. Now, the linear response, of course, comes right here. And what you'll be seeing later is that under conditions of high pressure and high density, where you begin literally to start overlapping the cores of these metals, the length scales that go along with the pseudopotential here actually lead to a very considerable increase in the strength of these things. The consequence of that is, as you might expect, that the linear response, which really depends on this thing here being quite small, begins to break down, and you begin to build up an importance of these three-particle interactions and beyond. Hydrogen is a nasty, nasty special case of this, where the work that we've been doing recently shows that the three-particle interactions set in a lot quicker than I think people had hitherto thought. We'll get probably to that on Friday. All right, so just a word that to make an obvious point here. What we start off with, the Hamiltonian for that electron system, for the nuclei, and for the interaction between them, has a remarkable symmetry about it. It's translationally invariant and it's rotationally invariant, but as you well know, and you just got to look around this room at the stuff that is in front of us, that symmetry is immediately broken. And the most obvious breaking of it is the formation of states where this one particle density here for the electrons actually is periodic. And so if you were to look at this for a strictly static lattice, the one particle density, for instance, for the nuclei would be a bunch of delta functions situated at a simple enough system at the lattice sites. All right. Now, if these sites are truly static, and of course, again, hydrogen is a particularly nasty example in this respect because it's so light, but if you take these things to be static, this is the problem now which has formed or is the basis of all this industry that's going on now, right, for periodic electron systems. And if the ground states are normal, I mean by that that there's no breaking of, for instance, electronic symmetry, which we could get in things like superconductivity, charge density waves, and the like, then the energy, as I said right away, just to start on the normal states, is a unique functional of this one particle density. Now that actually can be reconstituted in terms of an exact mapping, as was shown by Walter Cohn and Liu Sham, onto an equivalent set of single particle states, where all of the mystery of the business now is buried in this exchange correlation functional. And all the arguments about the functionals and so forth eventually devolve onto this object here, how well we know it. So the problem of calculating the electronic ground state energies of systems have proceeded, I think, by a route that many of you will know about, at least let's say an approximate way, that it tracks back to the Thomas Fermi method, one has approached these problems almost universally through what's called the local density approximation for the calculation of the total energy. It's surprisingly good, actually, to be quite candid. Even though it has its flaws, if you really want to get a kind of a first cut on the energetics of a system, it does pretty well. Now, it's agreed that it does overbind systems, and one of the more glaring flaws is that when you apply it, for instance, to things like the semiconductors and so forth, it does a pretty poor job on the band gaps. If you want to do a bit better on this, you can include, for instance, make the obvious observation, which I think was first made by van der Waals when he was doing exactly this for the calculation of the profile, the density profile between a gas and a liquid. He did it exactly the way that the folk are doing it nowadays, applied the local density approximation to his famous equation of state, put in a profile, did the Euler Lagrange minimization and so forth, came up with a rotten answer and said, surely the physics of the system depends not only on the density where we are, but the rate at which it's changing. So he put in square gradients and came up with an even worse answer and said, this stuff doesn't work. Now, it's amazing that it does work in the electron gas context. And if one puts in gradient corrections here, one can get rather considerable improvements. But the difficulty is, and I think this is pretty well acknowledged, is that the inclusion of gradients, for instance, the generalized gradient approximation, it's not universal. What I mean by that is that some systems, when you start improving the local density results with the gradient corrections, they do improve, some do not. For instance, the one you mentioned, was it David Silica? Well, somebody mentioned Silica this morning. There's one where if you actually calculate the equation of state with the local density approximation and then tinker with it by including these gradient corrections, you're better off not doing it. But there are other systems where it's it works quite well. So the message is here that although this seems like a reasonable thing to do, to acknowledge the fact that the energy of a system will depend on the energy locally and the rate at which it's changing, is reasonable. The way it's coming out at the moment is that the procedures are not universal. I might remark, by the way, that in the classical context, this story went after the van der Waals' experience. The way that people started dealing with inhomogeneous systems went a completely different route. And they went the route of what was called coarse grading or weighted density approximations. And some of those approximations are now, which have a classical heritage, are now beginning to find their way into the electron gas problem. All right. There is, by the way, though, one rather good route at doing this, but it turns out to be numerically extremely intensive. And that's to include the first dynamically screened Coulomb interaction to the self-energy of the electrons. That's Hedin's so-called GW approximation. It leads, in the few cases where it's been tried, to very considerable improvements, particularly on band gaps. And just think a minute about why that would be of interest to us. It's the closing of a gap very often that we take as the clue to the possible onset of a band overlap transition. So getting the gap right, as well as the total energy, is a rather important point. To do this, you need to have the frequency-dependent dielectric constant of a periodic system in here, and you've sort of got two n by n problems to compute to do this one. So it turns out to be very, as I said, computationally intensive. Anyway, so far as performance is concerned, if you think of at least normal and near normal densities, I think it's fair to say, and you'll see example of this on Friday in the case of hydrogen, good one, that structural energy differences are now coming out at the level of about a few millielectron volts per atom. You can even, for instance, people use these techniques to look at electronically ordered states, the spontaneously polarized perovskites. So it has the ability to deal with emerging long-range fields very well, spontaneous polarization. Equations of state are often in fairly good agreement with the experiment, but again, it's David's point here that you can do pretty well on energies, but once you start taking gradients and then a second one, these differences do begin to show up. I'll show an example later. All right. Now, just a remark about beyond the ground state. All those comments are dealing with the system essentially at t equals zero. If we now go beyond t equals zero but below melting, the density, of course, is still periodic. It's just that, as you might expect now, it begins to develop a structure. There's a characteristic width to this. We recognize that width, at least in reasonably harmonic systems, as a reflection of the phonons in the system, okay? It's an important width because if you take that width there, divide by nearest neighbor separation, that is essentially what's called the Lindemann ratio. And if that exceeds, let's say in a classical solid, a number like about 0.1, we know that it melts. In a quantum solid, this thing gets up to about 0.25, 0.28, something like that. So with dynamics here, the point about this plot now is where does it come from? And the view that's normally been taken on this is to go back to that resolution of the energy into pair, three body, and so forth potentials, and these are the things that localize the particles on the sites, and it's the dynamical problem that emerges from that that gets reflected in these widths here ultimately. So that's the first point. A common approach that's been used in our trade is to say, well, we recognize from a figure like this that there must be energy of motion bound up in the heavier degrees of freedom. So what is going to constitute now the true total energy of the system? I'm sorry, I shouldn't have used the word true. the correct total of, and it's on the face of it, it's not unreasonable to say, well, we'll just take the combined energies of the two systems and sum them. Well, there's a problem here, a little one. It may be a big one in hydrogen. And that is that, of course, the electrons interact with the phonons, which are giving rise to precisely this motion, right? And the consequence of that is that in the energy dispersion of the electrons around the Fermi energy and within a range of about, let's say, the Debye energy that's associated with this motion, you get a renormalization of the energy bands. And by the way, the manifestation of that thermodynamically is directly in things like the electronic specific heat, which gets renormalized. Now, think about that effect now and the fact that there's a very obvious mixing of excitations going on in here. Now think about the case of hydrogen, where the characteristic vibron energy before it separates is half a volt. And then think about, for instance, the analog of this effect when you begin to bring down the electronic energy levels by compression, right? To within, let's say, half an EV. And you get a very, very interesting and quite serious mixing of these effects going on. I'll come back to this on Friday, but here's a homework problem for you. you all know that band gaps in semiconductors are temperature dependent. That means to say the following: keep the system at constant volume, warm it up. We know that the band gaps actually go down, and it's just the Debye-Waller factor. And it's the same effect, of course, that one sees for waves in another context, namely photons. And so one route, one way of manifesting this physics is to say, well, you would expect, therefore, that the effect of the phonons is going to accelerate the band gap closing process. But now think of it the other way. Suppose you've got two levels almost degenerate, and you bring in a perturbation. What does it do? It usually splits it, right? Here's the homework problem for Friday. I'll tell you the answer on Friday. Okay, so the point here, though, is that the mixing of these 2 degrees of freedom can really lead to some quite interesting physics. There is the quantum Monte Carlo route, and I guess David will be telling us about that. I'm certainly not going to do it. I would feel like I was giving a lecture on floods and Noah was sitting in the audience. I will let David do that. And a very interesting point now, of course, for the planetary context is that we do want very much to start reflecting the fact that the single particle levels themselves, right, are not just the standard sort of Fermi step function, but are beginning to be seriously deoccupied, if you will, or spread out. And this kind of approach now, where one includes in the response functions, for instance, the occupancy changes, is now being used for matter under, let's say, increasingly extreme conditions. All right, just a word or two on liquids, was my charge from David. In a way, this is the true state of matter, right, because it's got the symmetry of a Hamiltonian. I see all of my shockwave colleagues nodding in agreement there. but the definition of it, as I said, is that the average of that one particle density operator on a microscopic scale is a constant that we can take as a definition. You have to remember now that so far as the electrons are concerned, there's a huge timescale difference in this. And on the timescale of nuclei, certainly, even though if one averaged over the eons, right, they're going to average out to a constant too, the electronic densities are far from that. It's the nuclear structure, and as we begin to condense electrons around them, the ionic structure, right, that is really required for electronic energies and also for transport. And what's key to the whole business is this pair correlation function. Now, if you had, for instance, a system that was not translation invariant, the starting definition of the pair correlation function is to factor out the one particle density at R, the one particle density at R prime. If you stop there, you would be neglecting correlations. And what's left, which in an inhomogeneous system is a function of two variables, right, is the pair correlation function. All right, if you have a fluid state, these are constant, and there is the familiar definition of G. Difference of two variables, right? Rotationally invariant if we don't have liquid crystals and so forth. All right, so that's the defining quantity, and as you remember, it has this character, and the fact that the pair correlation drops rapidly away to zero beyond some characteristic length scale here usually reflects, in that way we looked at resolving the energies in terms of pair, triplet, and so forth interactions, it usually reflects a steeply repulsive part of the effective interaction. Now this thing, and its density and temperature dependence, is crucial to understanding the fluid state. In the classical context, which is usually invoked, right, for the nuclear parts of the problems, especially I would suggest on the planets and so forth, I just want to illustrate the route that people have taken, at least one of them, to getting at, for instance, the structure of a fluid. But don't forget, the key input to this is a potential. And not just, for instance, a pair potential as we go up into these more highly compressed states. But if you subtract from 1, 1 from G, that gets you what's called the total correlation function, and 1 is what you would have for the uncorrelated system, so this is really manifesting the correlations in the system. This H is resolved here in what's called the equation of Oz at the end of the little yellow brick road or whatever. But it's the Ernstein-Zernike equation which defines now something which is central in the density functional theory of the classical systems. Now, for the electron folks here, this happens to be, in your language, this would be the second functional derivative of the internal energy with respect to density. And that's what it is here too, except it's a free energy. So this would be like taking the exchange correlation interaction and getting one further functional derivative, and then going to the homogeneous limit. This has played a very important role in the theory of liquids. In, I think, 54, in the Low Countries, it was shown that the G itself was could be written in terms of the pair interaction, this H, this C, and one extra bit, the so-called bridge function, in an exact resummation of the diagrammatic expansion for G, where the B here, the so-called bridge function, turns out to be a remarkably universal-looking function. And that's led that observation, which was made by Rosenfeld and myself some years back, has led to considerable simplification, actually, in implementing theories of the liquid state. One point I want to make is that if you were to put it, just combine it with the phi 2 here in a trivial way, call the result phi 2 tilde, that statement, G of R is e to the minus phi 2 tilde plus h minus c, coupled with that defining equation, that defines one of the great approximations in the theory of fluids, the so-called hypernetic chain approximation. Turns out that almost every equation that's ever been solved now, just by this observation, is of that character. It's just that you don't know what the phi 2 tilde is. All right, but that shows you now that there are ways of actually closing these things to get the key quantity, this this pair distribution function, and the Prokosiewicz approximation is another. Well, that's one route now to start generating, for instance, internal energies and free energies of liquid states. That's a route, and it can be generalized to mixtures, and it can get you these things. And, by the way, the Fourier transforms of G of R minus 1, which is related to the static structure factor. So that's one route. Now, second, another very fruitful avenue, is to try to set up the physics of the system that you're looking at in terms of, let's say, the physics, and here manifested as a Helmholtz energy, of a reference system and a correction between the potentials, one for the reference system and the other for the real. Now this is a rigorous, although you can get this immediately from first order thermodynamic perturbation theory, it turns out that this actually is a rigorous upper bound. So you can see now that if you start specifying your interactions in terms of parameters, you have a variational route now to the to the free energy for your system, and hence then for the pressure. Question?
Yeah, the equations 1, 2, 3, they give some kind of method to calculate the pair correlation function.
Right.
But the, on the other hand, the variational method, there you already put there known effective pair potentials.
Of course, the key here is to assume that there is a system that you know a lot about, right?
Okay.
So, for instance, do I say it here? Yes. The two that have pretty much dominated the business over the years of statistical physics have been the system of hard spheres, or high sphere mixtures, and we know an awful lot about that system. And the second one has been the one component plasma. Okay, so the presumption here is that you know something about a liquid state as a reference system, and then you correct for that, for the difference between the two interactions.
Sorry, and that means you determine the effective pair potential for this pair correlation function.
Effective what now?
Yeah, you are determining the effective pair potential VR for
pair correlation function. That's the reference system. Yeah. is there chalk here? Yeah. That term will be something like this. There'll be an average density. There'll be, for the reference system, a G of R. And then, let's say, the phi 2 that characterizes your real system diminished by the phi 2 that characterizes the reference system, right? So this is the kind, if you just stop there, that's the kind of expression you would write down for the pair energy in a system entirely dominated by pair interactions. As the point about this is that if you're lucky enough to be able to parameterize this thing, right? And so, for instance, or even this one, I mean, here's an example. Suppose you had a Leonard Jones system, like so. And that's going to be the real system. And then you have a hard sphere system with a sigma. Now, what sigma? So I can take sigma as a variational parameter and now minimize the free energy. Now you can do, of course, variations on that. Well, this is a very primitive one, but that's the idea.
But if I knew the pair correlation function, usually I also could calculate the effective pair potential, finally.
You want to invert this?
For the hard sphere system, it's not possible because all terms always cancel out in this term where I can calculate the potential when I know the pair correlation function. So in the hard sphere system, I have to make some assumption about the distribution of the hard spheres to get the right pair correlation function the good one for.
Yeah. You're asking, can we get the pair correlation function out of this procedure? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
No. This is a procedure which is designed to get the free energy. This problem here, right, where...
to get out the pair correlation functions out of the first three equations.
Right.
And when I do this for the hard sphere system, then I have to do some additional assumptions for the distribution of the spheres.
Now, let me state this again. I think you got off on the wrong track. I take two systems. They're isochoric and they're at the same temperature. Right. System one, we assume we know all about. So it could be a hard sphere system, but I'm free to change, for instance, if I keep the same density, I'm still free to change its diameter. Okay? The second system would be at the same density, the same temperature, but let us say a Leonard Jones system. Right? Now the statement is that the free energy of the Leonard Jones system is bounded above by the free energy of the hard sphere system with this to be chosen diameter plus the average, right, of this potential taken in the states of the hard sphere system. Okay, that's what I wrote down over there. So I can now systematically minimize this with respect to the choice of sigma. It doesn't tell you anything about the pair correlation function of the of the system. It's designed just for the free energy.
Yeah, That I understand. I just wanted to point out something different. There might be options.
Okay.
Yeah.
The power of it lies in the fact that it's a variational principle.
Yes, exactly.
And although you're not guaranteed to get close to 300, it's often the case.
No,
in variational approaches.
I didn't want to talk about the Gibbs-Fogel-Yukov equation or inequality. I wanted to focus on the calculation function. But we can talk about that.
Yeah. You can see from the way the physics has been set up here, this is the first term in what's called the Swanwick expansion. And if you terminate it at the first order, it happens to be in the classical system a rigorous upper bound. That was proven by both Gibbs and Bogle-Yubov. Okay? So it's specifically designed, and as David said, the beauty of it is that if you have the freedom of some parameters to adjust, you can do very well in getting that free energy. All right, well, I'm running a bit behind, but I guess that's the message of the day. I want to get on to the example of lithium, where there's a bit of a surprise coming. Just a quick comment about transport properties. Again, we heard this morning that they're largely dominated by electronic transport. Obviously, one has to worry about mass transport in things like the molten charge transfer or ionic systems. But if we focus, for instance, on electronic transport, the frequency-dependent conductivity is the current-current correlation function. And again, the whole point about writing this down in the standard linear response formalism is that what matters a great deal now is the choice of states in the system. If you go to the static limit, a quick estimate, for instance, of the conductivity of an electronic system, if we know phenomenological lifetimes, just comes from the standard Drude model. I've written it here in a way which is dimensionless. This is this dimensionless separation parameter related to the density that we introduced right at the beginning. Here now, h bar on tau, that clearly has the dimensions of energy, and I'm just writing everything now in atomic units. H bar and tau in Rydbergs. If you write this thing, it has the rather convenient number here, the inverse of the atomic unit of resistivity, which happens to be 21.7 microcentimeters. And that's a rather nice number to sort of carry around when dealing with, when looking into the resistivity of metals and the like. Now, the key issue, in my mind, once again, is again this issue of structure, because that's what's determining the arrangement of scatterers. And it's been manifested in two very different ways in the routes to the static and dynamic conductivity over the years. The first one, and it goes back, I think, to Zeiman, and it was coming online in the early 60s when I was a graduate student in Cambridge. was the weak scattering approach. And I just want to caution you now that this begins to fail in these light elements under compression, because the thing that determines the scattering cross sections, these pseudopotentials, are actually getting a lot larger than can be sustained in the Born approximation that goes into this thing. So the key physics in this, not surprisingly, is that one views the liquid metallic state as something with a pretty spherical Fermi surface. Electrons are being scattered on it, and the static resistivity, the inverse of the conductivity. It's the conductivity, by the way, that's determined by the linear response, and it's the resistivity that's determined by this weak scattering procedure. And so you see there are two elements to it. One is the structure, and there it is, as I was saying. And here it's just the static structure, and it's the Fourier transform of G diminished by 1.
What's the rho and bar there called the average density?
Excuse me?
Nothing.
Right. And the second thing is the square of this matrix element, or the pseudopotential that goes into the cross section. Okay. There have been attempts to extend this. We were involved in some. I'll just mention that Jim Langer here, with Timothy Neal, tried to extend the Bourne series by going to higher and higher corrections in this. And not surprisingly, you begin to run into a problem which is really quite endemic. And that is, as soon as you get into that route, you need information not just on pair correlations. You begin to involve the three-particle, four-particle, and so forth correlation functions. And that's still a matter of, let's say, great discussion these days about how these look. And not a great deal is known about the three-particle distributions in matter. So it's the same problem coming back now in a different guise to the one that I mentioned earlier when you attempt to resolve the energy into pair, triplet, and so forth interactions. It's coming back here also in transport. A possible difficulty is with planetary conditions, and I'll mention it now, we'll see it in a minute, is that the pseudopotential becomes highly non-local. That's because you're really beginning to probe the angular momentum characteristics of this thing at short range. And secondly, and I'll give the case of lithium in just a second, the bands actually narrow considerably in these things upon compression. And what goes into these kinds of approaches is the assumption that you start from a pretty free electron-like system. All right, the other limit is the strong scattering one, the Kubo-Piles-Greenwood linear response formula that I had above, where you need the current-current correlation function. In a different guise, it's just the same fundamental problem arising. And there's one other interesting aspect here, and that is that we started off with the idea of nuclei. We backed off and electrons. We backed off on the density. There was a condensation, right? Now, if you get up to the last step there, the last electron is going on, and we come to, let's say, atoms, very narrow bands possibly, and then just increase the density a little. So we go from states localized around the atoms to itinerant. Now, if we were to attach spin to this and so forth, we'd be start, I think, using language like Mott transitions and so forth. Imagine now that you have succeeded in getting a conducting state, and now you're squeezing it up, and you're getting to the point now where the next electron is just about to come off. If you like, you could think again, if we attach spin to this, you could begin to think as a progression or a cascade of Mott-like transitions as we go down. Now, each one of these gets us to a very interesting region, right, where the fluctuations just before we go to the state can, in a resonant way, begin to influence these cross sections quite considerably. So we might come back to that on Friday. All right, so I think I'll just finish up now with this case of where there's a bit of a surprise and how it's going to play out in the planetary context, I'll leave it to you to decide. But let's take the case of lithium. What we're finding now in sodium is that some of the physics that you'll now see is extremely similar. Here was the question I posed earlier. If you take a reasonably free electron-like system, let's say the classic case of the alkali metals, where you have a dispersion which is essentially quadratic, with an effective mass very close to one, perhaps a band gap with a rather weak gap at its own face, and a bandwidth which you remember goes as 1 over RS squared. So what's the expectation as we squeeze it? The common expectation would be that we would actually expect this band right, to broaden. Now, what's actually being found is exactly the opposite. We find a narrowing of the bands under conditions that I'll get to in just a moment. We find that, you know, the old rule was that as you squeeze things up, the structures ought to get simpler. It doesn't go that way at all. And we'll see the reason for that in a minute. And incidentally, just before these things happen, it looks like lithium has a pretty good chance of being a decent superconductor. And furthermore, you would expect in these so-called simple systems that as you squeeze it up, it ought to be, if anything, a better metal. And again, the evidence seems to suggest just the opposite.
You mean it becomes a worse metal than it goes superconducting?
That was before it goes into this pairing phase. All right. So now, what's the physics? What could possibly be doing this? Now, why we call these things simple is that it's an accident almost to one atmosphere physics that the volume occupied by the core structure in these systems is a rather trivial fraction of the entire cell volume. And it's in here, of course, that most of the primary information on the pseudopotential resides. So imagine the following. Suppose we had an obliging army of Maxwell's demons, and we asked them to take away all of the valence electrons. They're all gone. And while they're away, we ask the demons also to bring the cores into contact, or at least get them plausibly close together. And then you invite them to put the valence electrons back again. Now, keep this fundamental physical principle in mind, that the cores, of course, are exclusionary in the sense of Fermi statistics, right? So what actually happens is that when you try to put the electrons back in again, they are confined considerably now to these interstitial regions. You'll see a picture in just a minute. Now, you might say, well, surely there's a huge kinetic energy penalty to be paid by that. And that's true. And what the system does actually is to start distorting itself to get just a little bit more breathing room to accommodate these kinetic energy penalties. So you get a kind of localization by orthogonalization, and you get also a reflection on the length scales that are important here, as you can appreciate now, because you've driven them together, of these exclusionary effects, particularly the repulsive aspects of that, in the pseudopotentials. All right. So what I'm going to show you now are some results. Now, the warning here is that what's going on in the case of lithium, incidentally, this is all being predicted to happen at about 3 to 4-fold compression. But exactly the same physics obtains, as I think you can see, for the other elements, and this is where I think the planetary conditions may have an awful lot to say. So it's an all-electron method. We use both pseudopotentials and without. Lots and lots of K-points, huge cutoff energies and so forth to make sure of adequate energy convergence, which eventually is at the level of about 1 MeV per ion. Now, what you're going to see is the following focus. We're going to look, of course, at what's happening to these valence states and a very curious narrowing of the bands, which reflects this localization rather than broadening of electrons. But also, keep your eye on this lower set of bands. Now, normally, we don't care under ordinary conditions about the lower states in the atoms, but you folk in the planetary community do. So here's where there's a bit of a surprise. Now, there was a hint that something like this might be going on, but in an earlier work by the Florida group, Butker and Tricky, they didn't look actually at all of the kind of relevant structures, and that was an issue basically of the technology available in the day. Now one can look at a complete range of structures to look at which ones will truly minimize your energy. So here is lithium energy bands, VCC structure, normal density. And the blue crosshatched area is basically what gives, you can see from the parabolic behavior here, what gives lithium its usual designation as being a simple metal. Way down here, you see completely flat the 1s bands. Totally boring and uninteresting. All right, so now let's take that and now begin to compress it. And let's take it up to 2.7 times normal. And the first thing you begin to see is that these things actually don't broaden as much as you expect. And in addition, there's this very curious sort of flattening around the base here. That's the first. But second, you'll notice that 2.7 times normal density is enough now to bring these core states within range of each other. Start thinking in tight binding terms, right? You begin to develop a little dispersion. Now let's go up to 3.7 times normal. And now you see that the band structure is extremely unusual. It hasn't developed the wide free electron-like bands that you might have intuited, not at all. Furthermore, at this density, it actually turns out that the width of the 1s bands exceeds the width of the 2s bands, and that proceeds. Now, it's at about this juncture that this aspect of localizing the electrons in the interstitial region becomes too punitive. And the system decides that
that value of I sub s is about the same as the normally defined I sub c of the superpotential. Is that right?
Oh, you mean where the cores are? Yeah.
Looked at the usual description of lithium at low pressure and tried to use a superpotential approach, you would say you've got an I sub C of about 2.
Yes.
Which is sufficiently small compared to I sub S, but now that's no longer true.
No longer true. And all that says, David, is that you know, the core physics is really beginning to play a really quite important role. Okay.
Is BCC the lowest energy crystal structure?
Excuse me?
Is BCC the
No, I'm just giving that as an example. Since you mentioned the point, there's the kind of zoo of crystal structures you can begin to look at. And BCC, hexagonal, this is relative to FCC, diamond, 9R, and so forth. And I guess that's a bit of a testimony to the ability of the methods we have now, an electronic structure, that you can do this. Now, even this, by the way, was not sufficient to determine what was going on in lithium. There was a paper recently by Siasson and co-workers where they've measured the structure now of lithium at high compression, and it's rather interesting. They find that it's exactly in this region that, as we were suggesting, that you get these instabilities, but the structure it goes into is entirely remarkable. It's cubic, but it has 16 atoms per unit cell. I doubt whether any theorist would have guessed that ahead of time, and it just shows you the value of the experiment. But the main point is that these things are completely unstable now, these high compressions, to extremely unusual structures. Incidentally, while we've got that up there, very, very recent, in fact, I think it's coming out shortly, paper by Novikov and Christensen on lithium gives you an idea now on this derivative aspect, right? So the energy is one thing, but the equation of state is quite another. And here now, the C16 is the 16 atom per unit cell cubic structure. You see there are, I would say, fairly significant departures from the measured equation of state and the theoretical one. So we're not still completely out of the woods on these numerical issues determining derivative properties in particular.
I understand that the effective mass of the electron is really affected by this. There should be lots of experiments to see this directly.
I think you're asking, can we, let's say, do some of the traditional measurements to determine effective masses in a diamond cell? Possibly.
Yes.
With a lot of luck. Yeah.
Very large.
It's a very large effect, and actually, I want to finish up on that. The here now is just to make good on the promise. Here is the form of the electron density now in the structure that lithium wants to take up above around about 100 gigapascals. And there's a very obvious pairing of the lithium atoms going on, but you notice that there's an almost complete absence of electrons between them. So this is not the kind of covalent bonding that's going on. So the red indicate now the position of the ions, and the blue, these are contours of electron density. And I think you see a very obvious pairing, right, of electrons in here. I don't want to make too much of that point. But the interesting point, I think, as you can see here, is that...
Are those low density? Where are you pointing to those blue?
The highest density is there. Okay, yeah.
Electrons.
So
it's valence electrons?
And remember, these are valence electrons, yeah.
So,
remember
the positive charge.
So let me recapitulate that argument. You take the electrons away, bring the cores into contact, put them back, right? They're excluded by orthogonalization, they're localized in the interstitial region, and eventually it pays. Of course, you can imagine there's a Madelung penalty to do this pairing, electrostatic penalty, that it pays the system to pair up because the electrons can then reduce their kinetic energy a little. So that's what's going on here. Now, but just to finish up, the state that you get here now is not at all the kind of nearly free electron state that one expects. So now imagine going a layer lower. Here it was with lithium, right? But let's start with sodium, and this is the case we're looking at now. The first thing is that sodium does exactly the same thing. Pairs up at sufficiently high density. But now let's start increasing the density even higher. Okay, so to the point now where you begin to bring in the next innermost core into contact. And you can see that this whole effect begins to cascade downwards. So it's just a little bit of a warning that the there may be in the computation, let's say, of the transport properties in particular, as you begin to squeeze up the density, there may be irregularities that are now reflecting exactly this kind of localization and delocalization physics that's going on.
It'll be more regular as you get higher in C, the sequence.
In principle, yes. Yeah. So this has only been found so far in the relatively light elements. So you know, we can't make a blanket statement on that. But it's interesting to consider the consequences now of, let's just say, this principle of localization by orthogonalization.
What does the photon spectrum look like for this? That is to say, what's the difference in the energy scale for the optical modes relative to the usual?
Right, yeah. We calculated this one. It's at about 1,600 wave numbers at this density. The typical zone boundary acoustic one was around about 900. Now, it's not so extreme as you have in hydrogen, but it's decently extreme. So that's an interesting question, obviously, David, because if we can get lithium squeezed up to where it does pair, then an immediate check is by Raman, isn't it, for that, to look for the Vibron for this.
What's the pressure?
About 100 GPa, 90-something.
Might that not also suggest, however, that in the liquid state, or somewhat up from the melting point, that you don't get the pairing anymore? Keep the density constant, increase the temperature. Let me explain what I'm getting at. In the normal way of thinking about pressure metallization, one thinks about the parameter R sub C characterizing the core and R sub S characterizing the electron spacing. When they become equal for a particular configuration, you say, aha, I need a new configuration. In the simple way of thinking about it, you think of it as not metal. What you're telling us is that there are structural configurations which are not in fact metals but insulators, but I would wonder whether that's true at high temperature.
Mm, right.
Because really what you're saying generalized is that, of course, whenever you have this characteristic of R sub C of order R sub S, something funny happens. Mm-hmm. And I agree with that. The question is whether it has to be insulated.
Right. Well, observe, first of all, you satisfy the necessary condition, right? This is obviously paired, so you must have an even number of electrons per unit cell. Now, when we looked into exactly this question, what is the state, we found very curiously that, in fact, for this picture, that what you are getting here is what's called a zero-gap semiconductor, something, again, that Walter Cohn and Sherrington looked at in some detail. This is where you get bands crossing, right, just at the Fermi energy. So technically, that's a zero gap, but you have a system of filled bands. So the issue of temperature, the issue of structure is now crucial. To get that configuration, you've got to have a crystal. I think it's probably, it will not survive the transition to the fluid state. And incidentally, you saw that on that plot I gave of the various structural differences in energy. I mean, they're very slight, just a few MeV. So I doubt very much that the pairing state would exist in the fluids, but this principle of unusual electronic densities, you know, reflecting localization by orthogonalization, that will. It's just the fact that I think our assumption that we can proceed with these weak scattering models to calculate transport, that's the thing that's at issue.
Neil, do you mean to apply that as you increase the density that the p-electrons can start becoming involved in this? I mean, that for sodium, for example, you got that tension.
Yeah. Right. We the three S ones, because you're going to work on this one, Neil, right? It's this one is, I think we estimated it's going to come in about 8 megabars.
Yeah.
This one is, but that's a heavy vacuum for you people, isn't it? yeah, it's the same idea, and we found actually that sodium has an RS of around 4, 1 atmosphere. You only have to take it to RS equals 2 to start seeing these effects, and in fact, at RS equals 2, that's 8-fold compression, already these core bands, again, are wider than the valence bands. It's quite extraordinary.
So here there's a minimum in the valence electron density at the ion, between the ion sides.
Right.
What about the core electron density? Can you say anything about that? Is it really a pairing in that sense?
No, not really. This is all just the standard electron densities. It's a little bit reflected in here, but you remember that the 1s wave function in lithium is just like it is in hydrogen, except the range is a naught on 2,
mm-hmm.
Right? So you can immediately get an estimate of what those densities are just from hydrogenic orbitals.
And I guess what I'm trying to get a feeling for is, what does it look like? Is it piled up in between them?
The core density?
Yeah, it would seem like it has to be.
Think of a cusp-like structure here,
uh-huh.
Okay? Think of one here. These are a separation, the separation here is sufficient that you have a decent amount of overlap between these two things. Now, if you had, let's say, a single electron, not a pair, but a single electron on each of the nuclei, then those two would immediately give you a Van der Heide-London type of bond. But because the spin has been satisfied on each one of them, you don't get that. All right, so let me stop there. Yes.
I mean, lithium has been observed, reported to be in the surface of some brown dwarf.
I saw that. That was in
Scientific American.
Yeah.
That's in low densities.
Yeah, that's in cold caches.
Yeah.
Is that known?
Yeah.
What do you mean by low?
Depends on the atmosphere in this room.
Okay.
You've been to the brown dwarf.
I think you're saying if you conserve it, it's
well, it's also very much diluted in hydrogen and helium. Mm-hmm. That's a trace sure. element.
I think tomorrow a number of speakers will address that.
Okay.
Show a spectrum. If you like.
I'll just finish by pointing out that Russ Hemley and I wrote in 1998, I think it was in August, an essay on the role that pressure can play in the condensed matter sciences, starting off again from this fundamental point of view. It contains, if you're interested, a number of quite interesting examples, including, for instance, the ionic systems. It's been known for quite some time that if you take, say, cesium iodide, and you remember that cesium and iodine bracket xenon, now you get to a very interesting issue about the role of charge transfer under high pressure. Because if you look at the equation of state of cesium iodide, as soon as you get them up to about, I think it's 3 or 4-fold compression, the equation of state of cesium iodide is almost identical to that of xenon. And that's telling you something quite interesting about the nature of electron states, and in particular, the way in which charge transfer can survive the high-pressure environment. So even though you manifestly have these differences in atomic number and so forth, at very, very high compression, a lot of the consequences of those differences begin to ameliorate very quickly. All right, so that and other examples can be found in that article. Thank you.
Thank you.